Poddo.
Bim bom bim bom, bim bom bim bom, bim bom bim bom, bim bom bim bom.
Welcome to the polling station. I am Joe Twyman from the public opinion consultancy Delta Poll.
And I'm journalist Marie LeConte. Hello.
Hello, Marie. It's been quite a week. What have you been up to?
It has. I went on the Labour battle bus, which I was so excited about. Like, generally, every election, I really wanted to go on a battle bus. But crucially, and, you know, I'm happy to admit I have some fault in this, I never actually asked any of the parties if I could go on the battle bus. I was waiting to be asked, like a good Catholic girl. And this time it happened.
Do you take part in a real battle on a battle bus?
No, so I did. Like, genuinely, I had to talk myself down with some great difficulty from trying to find a suit of armour. Just going like, clink, clink. Oh, there's been a terrible misunderstanding.
Well, at the very least, a massive banner.
And I was a bit like, eventually, like the only thing that stopped me was realising that actually my finances are quite tight at the moment. That would have been so much money spent on a very, very short-lived bit.
And what happens on a battle bus?
Well, I wouldn't fucking know, Joe, because actually when they say, ooh, come on the battle bus, it'll be so fun, what they mean is there is a battle bus with, you know, party people and MPs and, like, candidates, etc., and all the party bigwigs. And then there's another bus, another poxy little bus for the journalist, which I should say, actually, it was a very nice bus, but it is just the journalist and basically some people who do operations for the Labour Party. And if you ask them any questions about stuff, they'll be like, oh, just put that in an email to the press office.
We're going to move on now to audience questions. We've actually received questions from our loyal listeners and viewers.
Which I really like as well, because I generally believe we ask for questions so that they're the best kinds, like entirely unsolicited.
If you do have any questions, though, be sure to hit us up on our respective socials. But for this week, we've got a series of questions to answer. Firstly, from Henry Dyer, might you have some deep dive coverage of contests in the South Coast?
Ooh.
Well, we'll come on to constituency of the week later, but I do think that Penny Mordaunt's contest in Portsmouth is really interesting.
It is, yeah. I don't think she's having the best time necessarily.
Well, her constituency, Portsmouth North, is a bellwether. In other words, It's a constituency that follows the winning team. And it's certainly looking like it's going to be a real scramble for her to hold on to it, which, of course, then has really important implications for future Conservative Party contests. And certainly the description of the runners and riders as the Kemmies and the Pennies would have to be revised if Penny was thrown out of Parliament.
I know, and it must be such a weird thing, because I've definitely heard from several people that she is quite actively preparing to run for the leadership. So imagine going from that life to just not having a job at all whatsoever, like from one to the next. But I think so, and she's probably in a really tough situation, but I think quite a lot of Tory MPs at the moment in kind of like nominally safe Tory seats. I think anyone in not super safe Tory seats is a bit like, I've lost, that's that. But you know, I've definitely spoken to some MPs who would not have worried in a different election, kind of going, yeah, we have no idea. There's kind of no way of knowing. And also at this stage, not always clear how much we can do as just like as candidates, as people, like, fine, we can go knock on some more doors. Is that really going to change anything? Well, like, you know, the tide may take you out or it may not. And I suspect Penny is one of those MPs kind of going, it is just unknowable at this stage.
And maybe the next Conservative leader will come from further down the South Coast.
Ooh. Well, just the sea. It's a fish. The next Conservative Party leader is a fish.
You heard it here first, folks. We've also received a message from the lovely Natasha Clark, who asks, is it pronounced polling or polling? Or, someone else has added, polling. What do you say?
No, so I think, obviously, we discuss, I don't want to let listeners, you know too much about our, you know, how we prep for the podcast, but we did discuss the questions in advance. I know, shocking. And I got wildly into my own head about this. Like, I think I said it out loud to myself a number of times, just in an empty room. I'm not sure, because I feel like, because I worry, because obviously, because English is my second language, there are some words that apparently I've been saying wrong all this time, but no one's ever bothered to tell me. So I'm quite scared it's going to be one of those. I would say, Joe, polling.
That sounds like polling.
Oh
me.
God!
No. I'm not saying that's bad. I say polling.
Polling. Polling. Polling.
Polling is an alternative, but I'm not sure. It's one of those.
No,
things
I feel like there's a little. I think it's a soft little O. Like you go up a little bit and then you go down a little bit.
It's a good
like,
question,
oh,
though, isn't it? And it I do is. Wonder if there are regional variations. Might someone with a Scottish brogue say polling?
I will not be attempting accents, but thank you so much for that.
That was my Scottish accent. I don't know if you picked up on that.
I think we should do subscribers like paying subscribers only special later, where we just say the word polling in lots of different ways.
Well, that's funny because James Mawillis, I assume that's like Majuli, reference there from the early 2000s. James yeah. Mawillis on Twitter says, is there an Acast Plus supporter feature? Well, obviously, we'd never go on Acast, would we? But
nope.
some sort of behind-the-scenes extra, perhaps on my OnlyFans site or something like that.
For every pound from subscribers, we'll say polling in a different way. We just have to come up with a different pronunciation each time.
So thank you all for your questions. And if you do have any related to anything we've talked about or seemingly anything we haven't talked about.
Honestly, literally anything. Yeah, we'll
send it in. All helps.
We should probably talk about some polling at this stage. Again, this was a terrible idea, I think, to talk about the pronunciation of the word very early on in the podcast, because every time we say that stupid word now...
Yeah, Natasha's ruined it for...
She really has. But anyway, I think... we should probably talk about MRPs because they've been on
the scene. It's actually pronounced MUP.
No. So my thing for quite a long time was trying to like, it never caught on, which I'm really disappointed about, but I wanted to call them BRRRP. You know, like cats when they do a little, like when they wake up. Sort of BRRRP.
When YouGov was developing it...
The first one I remember was just like, oh!
Well, yeah, we'll come on to that. But when in the early days when YouGov was developing it, Stephen Shakespeare at YouGov was very keen to call it Mr. P. But... Here's a surprise that never caught on.
If I give you £20, would you be happy to say Mr. P instead of MRP somewhere on live television or radio?
No.
£25.
Okay, £25. I'll tell you what, we'll put it on the put it on the podcast extras. I first encountered MRP many years ago now.
Oh my God, an MRP hipster.
I was working at YouGov at the time and had assembled a team of academics to take our data and work with it to come up with interesting stuff. And that was called Project Avengers because obviously I'm a massive geek.
Was it actually? Oh, God.
No, it really was.
Oh, that is really mortifying. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And this was in early sort of 2015.
I'm very clever and you know, knowledgeable and so on and so forth, as well as very well-dressed. But other listeners may want to get a quick refresher on what an MRP actually is. Just like a quick, again, this is not for me in any way, because I know I could do it myself, but I feel like it'd be better for you to do it.
Okay, so everyone at home, sing along. MRP is short for multi-level regression with post-stratification weighting.
Oh, that was nice. Have you? Did you train?
Yes. As you can see, I'm classically trained. What does that actually mean? How does it work? The way that I think is a good way to understand it is think about Lego. A conventional pole will be like a constructed ball of Lego.
Okay.
And you want to estimate what the individual constituencies are going to do. And so you get that big ball of Lego and you break it up into lots of individual pieces. And each one of those pieces is one of the constituencies. And you can use techniques like uniform national swing, the favourite of David Butler, the godfather of sophology. Mm. You can use techniques like that to break that big bit of Lego down into the individual blocks. The way MRP works is to turn that process around. It uses a whole load of data and statistical modelling from things like the census and other data sets as well to get a sense of what each individual constituency looks like. Mm-hmm. It then uses large samples, much larger than traditional conventional
Lamples,
surveys.
Lamples, we call them in the business.
So whereas a traditional conventional survey might use 1,500 to 2,000 respondents, you might get 20, 30, 40,000 in an MRP survey. And they use all those respondents to then model each of the individual constituencies. So each of those individual pieces of Lego will be statistically modeled and produced using this data. Mm. And then that is all combined to make the single piece of Lego.
To make a massive Lego dick and balls.
Out of the individual pieces. But the really important thing to remember is that the process that you go through to model that those individual constituencies varies depending on MRP. And MRP is a bit like statistical weighting All conventional polls use statistical weighting to estimate national figures. But statistical weighting will vary from pollster to pollster. They'll use different variables and targets and things like that. And it's similar with MRP modelling, which variables you throw into your process, which data you use, that's all important. And models vary from agency to agency, which is why you can get a situation as we had this week.
Yeah, because this week was, I mean, I am sorry to say, I found it really funny if like, it was in like three of them released in quite short succession.
Three of them
were
released within hours of each other.
Yeah.
But it's worth pointing out one of those, the one from More in Common, for instance, the fieldwork for that began on the 22nd of May.
Oh,
exactly. Might a few things have happened since the 22nd of May?
And I've been in
during
a coma,
an election campaign? Yes, of course. And so that couldn't take full account of those events. And similarly, and perhaps most importantly, MRP models don't take account of hyper-local factors.
I knew that.
So in other words, if, let's say, Nigel Farage is running in your constituency, can't take account of that. Let's say, I don't know, Rishi Sunak is the Prime Minister and he's running in your constituency. Doesn't take account of that, et cetera, et cetera. And so these are all using a series of assumptions and decisions that vary depending on who's producing the poll. Right. And indeed, some pollsters adjust their model as they go along.
Right. Okay.
Now, they would say, and we have no reason to dispute this, that they are improving it, improving the process. But
they're just making it worse each time. Like they've been very clear.
But still, exactly. They, it's these are things that can take. I mean, we use models for private work, private commercial work at Delta.
They go to another school,
and they go to another school, and most importantly, they take years to develop. And so, would one that's perhaps produced in less time be more effective or less effective? Again, it depends on the assumptions and the decisions made.
So I guess my next question is a bit of a tough one, which is that sort of from the outside, and obviously, yeah, we all remember where we were when that massive MRP came out in 2017 and kind of changed the course of the narrative of the election, blah, blah, blah. 2019, we had quite a few, but this really feels like the MRP election. And I can't tell. So the thing I can't quite tell is that because they genuinely are a lot better and precise than kind of like more conventional just opinion polling? Or is it just that, you know, because I think Westminster does do that thing of going, ooh, a shiny thing, this shiny pebble is going to be my favourite pebble, my favourite toy for the rest of time. And then they move on and find another pebble, etc. So is it right that we're paying that much attention to MRPs compared to like traditional polling? Or is it just a shiny pebble?
I would take everything into account. And so conventional polls, MRP polls, they all add to our understanding, if they're conducted correctly. They all add to our understanding of where the public are. But if they're not done correctly, they could actually make the situation worse. If you look at some MRP polls, for instance, they show, because of the way that the modelling works, they show the Conservatives improving their position in this election in areas like Liverpool, which seems a little odd because of the way that this modelling works. Yeah. But ultimately, all these things are designed to provide a link between the share of the votes and the share of the seats, which is really difficult to work out because of 650 constituencies across the country, which all have individual factors which will have an impact to a greater or lesser degree. And so it's always going to be difficult to do that. The exit poll, for instance, when it comes out, as many people will know, doesn't talk about individual constituencies. Yeah. It just gives a constituency count. I think there's a very good argument that MRP should be used in a similar way to talk about seat counts. But of course, to go back to your question about why people do it, a lot of people do it because it then drives traffic to their website.
Yeah.
Because you can say, go onto our website and check out your constituency. And so I can see from a marketing point of view why you'd want to do it that way.
Yeah.
But my personal view is that actually for the general public, for general consumption, a seat count might be more helpful. Maybe.
And I think you've kind of slightly touched on a broader point here, I think, which is that, again, it's been the MRP election, it's been the polling election. And I think that it's partly symptomatic of the fact that not a tremendous amount has happened. So, you know, obviously you had D-Day and you had the betting stuff, which we'll get onto in a second. But aside from that, you know, we kind of know what's going to happen. There's not been a tremendous amount of, like, stuff. But I'm finding it increasingly frustrating in like meta that so much coverage is just about the polling. I mean, it's a bit like, I don't know, like, not to get on my high horse, you know, journalists have to explain what's going on to people and stuff. But if I were like just a normal, regular person who doesn't happen to be a massive nerd, I'm not convinced I would want to buy the paper every day and just read about polling. It has really informed the narrative so much.
I completely agree. But I would say, particularly in this election, that's because of the absence of anything else.
Yeah.
And so lots of polls are out there. So you'll always, if you've got to fill your 24-hour news service, if you've got to tweet about something for attention, if you've got to talk about something in your newspaper or on your radio show, then every day there'll be a new poll out. Whereas actually, what do the parties put out every day? Yeah. If you're lucky, stage-managed, tightly controlled photo opportunity.
Yeah. Fucking boring, let me tell you.
A battle bus where you're not even allowed on the bus. The days of the...
And they took my sword.
The days of the early morning press conference every morning, setting out the agenda, are long gone. And there's been so little content. And you could argue, quite understandably, the Conservatives don't really want to put anyone up because they're in such a bad position. Mm. Labour don't want to rock the boat, so they don't want to do anything that scares people.
Yeah.
And... There's only so many photos you can have of Ed Davey falling off stuff. Mm. And so given that, I think that polling has been promoted in this election in the absence of anything else. I think if there were grand narratives emerging from the campaign, we'd focus on that. But there just aren't.
But it is a bit, and obviously no offence to your people, all of whom I love dearly. But it's been quite dull, though.
I agree, and now a poll. And that's
ooh.
The other thing, because the polls actually haven't shown much in the way of change, as you would expect.
Yeah.
And so...
people getting incredibly excited by, like, a very, very slight outlier that's still within the, like...
And Nigel Farage is a good example of that. Mm. And so you have the event with Nigel Farage, where he talks about the fact that Reform UK are ahead of the Conservatives. Well, they're only ahead by one point, and as we've previously discussed, that's within the margin of error. But also, more closely, when you look at these things, you find that prior to that event, that week, five polls were published. Only one of them had Reform UK ahead. By the end of that week, you have 12 polls covering the same fieldwork period, and only one of them had Reform UK ahead. And the average Conservative lead was 5%. And yet, Nigel Farage focuses on the outlier. Of course he does.
Because
he's a campaigner, and he can. But then the press picks up on that, and that becomes the story, because there's nothing else to talk about. And round and round and round we go.
Then,
it stops, nobody knows.
Because I was about to say, because then that gets quite meta, surely. Like, let's say you're actually a Conservative voter, but you'd been wavering. Maybe you'd been thinking about, like, you know, going towards the Lib Dems, or maybe even going Labour, whatever. You know, one of the kind of seven voters they have left. If you see a ton of headlines going, ooh, Reform and Farage, you know, are actually ahead, would you not be tempted to be like, oh, fine, for fuck's sake, like, I guess I'll go back to the Tories? I think I'm always really interested in, like, voting behaviour, although I think with the massive caveat, if that's what you're about to say, that so few people meaningfully kind of follow politics, that there's probably not tons. You know, it's not necessarily stuff you can see really showing in the data of that massive points going up and down and stuff, but for people who are interested in politics, I would be, really interested in knowing how that kind of shapes the decision, especially people who are not kind of diehard for one single party.
Academics from the University of Bath have looked into this in a systematic, quantitative fashion. And the paper that they produced talked about two things. Firstly, it talked about turnout being affected. And so how when there's a big gap and it seems certain that one party is going to win, as is indeed the case this time around, that's certainly the prevailing narrative. And if you're paying any attention to the election at all, that's what you'll hear. Yeah. There is a suggestion that that then suppresses turnout, which is entirely logical and understandable. There's then the question of the bandwagon effect, which is what you're talking about, the idea that, oh, well, this party's on the rise, I'm suddenly going to engage in this and maybe I'll vote for them.
Oh, no, that's strong horse theory.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no, because I mean the opposite. I mean, I get weak horse theory of, like, Tory voters who would be like, I normally wouldn't have bothered, but if Reform are doing so well, then maybe I should go back to my boys.
That's why the evidence on bandwagon effect is more mixed.
Right.
Because people do respond in different ways. And so, whereas for turnout, it's much more clear for how it motivates people in different ways will vary from person to person. Mm.
Do we think I should do a paper on weak horse theory? Because I quite like it now.
By all means, submit it to peer review.
Will do.
Should we also talk about betting?
Oh, I suppose we should, yeah. Are you actually a betting man, Joe Twyman?
No, I am not a betting man, with the exception of the large amount of money that I have won betting on very specific political contests. Mm. And I see that not so much as betting, I see that as taking money off people who challenge my expertise. If an armchair expert out there is willing to put his money where his mouth is, and I assume it always is a he, and bet that he knows more about something than me, I am happy to take that money from him. I would characterise it that way. And certainly the Theresa May memorial sofa that I sit on each evening is testimony to that.
It is a weird thing, and we'll get onto the bigger stuff in a second, but you know, the occasional like decent odds you can get, which I think are based entirely on just people who are very ideological, being very hopeful, etc. Because I remember, so I think the first time I put a bet, I want to say it was in 2015, general election, where for some puzzling reason you could get decent odds on Plaid Cymru getting more seats than UKIP, and it was like, but they obviously are going to get more seats than UKIP. Like, this is such a weird, like, you know, and I didn't make, like, I think I put a fiver or something, but yes, yeah, so I always find it really interesting. I think the famous recent example is probably the last US election as well, where like, that is the only time I've ever put a large bet on something, because the odds weren't that good. But for, I would say, a full, what, like 24, 36 hours after that, like, we knew for certain Joe Biden had won, you could still bet because the Trumpers were insane and also in the denial stage of grief.
Well into December, you could still get sort of a 10% return.
Yeah.
Because people were so ideologically driven that they believed Trump was going to be president. And so you could bet £3,000 and get £300 back.
That is exactly what I did. That, especially, like, I think specifically £3,000, because I think that's all I had in savings at the time. And I was, I'm just going to put my entire savings there.
And where else are you going to get a 10% return in a month?
No, exactly.
And what's interesting about that is, of course, it's an illustration of the fact that ideology drives people's decisions on betting exchanges in a way that it doesn't drive their belief when it comes to sort of horse racing in a lot of cases. But it may do it with football, for instance. It's a variation on that. I want to demonstrate my love for the England team, so I'm going to bet money on that. And this is a variation on that. I want to demonstrate just how much I believe in Donald Trump or Nigel Farage, and so I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. And yeah, it's very easy to see how people get wrapped up in that. But at the same time, it's very easy to take their money from them in such circumstances. Particularly when, as I say, after the result of the US election had been declared,
it was really weird.
You could still get a 10% return.
Again, I enjoyed it, but yeah.
But of course, we're not talking about that exactly this week, are we?
No, we're not. I believe we're talking about the number of people around kind of Rishi Sunak and Number 10 putting bets on the date of the election when they knew about the date, but no one else did.
And of course, these investigations are ongoing, so we probably shouldn't comment on any specific cases.
Absolutely. But, yeah.
But having said that.
Yeah. Anyway. So I actually kind of want to open this by being, and I don't usually think of myself as a kind of like controversialist and stuff, but it's clearly a bad political story because it's a bad look for the Conservatives. So I think Labour can clearly get one rule for them, one rule for you, etc. Like, it looks grubby, but is it actually criminal? Should it be criminal? Like, I'm finding this surprisingly conflicting, actually.
I don't understand the legal status. A lot of the reports say that individuals are being investigated by the Gambling Commission, but I don't understand what that means, or indeed if they have actually broken any laws. As I understand it, you're not allowed to bet on privileged information. So in other words, the sort of betting equivalent of insider trading. But I don't know what counts as privileged information. And I also don't know what not allowed to means. Does that mean you've broken the rules and conditions of the betting site or the bookmakers?
No, exactly.
Does it mean you've actually broken some law and could be thrown in jail or fined? I don't know what the situation is, but none of the reporting seems very clear on that.
Yeah, I suspect that it's one of those where no one actually knows, because otherwise, again, like, the phrasing in the news stories, I think, would be a lot clearer.
I have a really interesting experience in this, because on more than one occasion, but particularly one specific...
Is this Joe's crime section? I'm excited.
One specific occasion I remember, one of the bookmakers, and I can't remember which one it was, but I think it was quite one of the big ones, had allowed people to bet on what the next result of a YouGov poll would be. While I was at YouGov producing that poll. They didn't contact us in advance to say that they were doing this, nor did they contact us while it was going on to say, obviously you guys can't bet on this, or this would be against this law, that law, this rule to do that. They just let it out there. Now, we had a policy at YouGov of not betting on any private information. And so it wasn't an issue. But it seems surprising to me that that this sort of thing clearly goes on, and yet only now we're seeing examples of being people being pulled up on it. I mean, everyone knows the story about, for instance, MPs making a lot of money about Michael Martin becoming the new speaker of the Commons. This is back in the 2000s. Tony Blair, the name of Tony Blair's child, Leo, that was something that was bet on by MPs as well. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. And most interesting, perhaps from a strategic point of view, the massive uptick in the amount of betting that was taking place gave Morgan McSweeney over at the Labour Party an indication that we would be on for a July election.
Which was, that was quite a clever thing. But again, yes, I'm really interested in where you draw the line, because I think, and as you mentioned earlier, I think a lot of political betting only really works if you're, you know, if you're a Westminster person, effectively. And I think lots of leadership contest stuff, you can probably get decent money just out of, like working in Westminster and talking to people and getting a really good sense of what's going to happen, etc. But like, at what point does that cross over again into like an amount of information a kind of random person couldn't possibly have? Like, it is, and I guess that's a more philosophical concern, but I do find it quite interesting where there's presumably stuff I could have bet on, because I don't know, let's say this is generally like a random fictional example, but if there's a leadership contest about to happen between like three people, and if, let's say, as a gossip minded kind of political journalist, I know that one of them, I don't know, like killed a man once, and you know, I would definitely bet on the one remaining person that seems most likely to win, etc. And then what point does that go, like, do we go from that, which is probably, you know, the people who consider to be socially acceptable, into the line where it becomes something that is either a crime or are definitely incredibly frowned upon?
Or similarly, let's say that you're a pollster and the leadership and the leadership contest that you're talking about takes place, and you as a pollster independently run a survey that shows that one of the people is ahead by some distance. Do you then bet on that? And if you do bet on that, is that then privileged information as well? Because anyone could conduct the poll if they wanted to. But what if, and here's where things get really murky, what if that poll shows that someone is well ahead, and by showing that they're well ahead because of the bandwagon effect that we had earlier, you actually make it a foregone conclusion? Are you then manipulating things?
In the same way that I was once, this isn't really related to anything, I'd just forgotten until we started talking about betting, when Alan Rusbridger left The Guardian as editor-in-chief, for a brief period of time, I was the fourth most likely person to become next Guardian editor on whatever website it was at the time, who decided to run odds on that. Because again, I think it's literally like four friends of mine had found it really funny and like put a fiver on.
Well, of course, there is a long history of leadership contests reflecting that people putting bets on themselves in order to elevate their position to make them be seen as a more serious candidate. But you know, people who do that might go to prison for other reasons later on, so you know, we'll have to see. So now we get to it. Hang on. Constituency of the Week.
It's been so fun, I just have to go. Jesus Christ.
So here we are. I thought this week we could discuss the constituency of Richmond and Northallerton in Yorkshire.
Ooh, fancy that.
That, for those who don't know, is Rishi Sunak's constituency, and it's,
which was until recently like one of those seats, right, where you could put a fucking like Tory rosette on a donkey and they'd win, right?
Well, I wouldn't characterise Rishi Sunak in that way, but it is true that that it was a very safe
Maybe a little meerkat.
Seat.
I feel like he'd be a meerkat. He's got a meerkatty person. So if you put a blue rosette on a meerkat, then they would win.
When this was the constituency just of Richmond, before North Allerton was added, it was previously William Hague's constituency, and now, of course, it's Rishi Sunak's. He won with just the small 27,000 majority last time around, with nearly two-thirds of the vote. Labour were in second place, but a long way behind. The reason we're mentioning it this time around is that MRP surveys, as discussed, occasionally point to the danger of Rishi Sunak losing his seat.
That would be a first, wouldn't it, in British politics, I believe, a prime minister losing their seat.
Yes. There's a slightly more complicated situation with Arthur Balfour at the turn of the century, I think in the 1904 election. But certainly in modern political history, nothing like this has ever occurred. And indeed, no one's quite sure what would happen, thanks to the brilliant way that Britain handles these sorts of things. We don't have specific rules about this. I think were the Prime Minister to lose their seat and their party still win the election, that would be more of an issue and we might be plunged in some sort of weird constitutional crisis.
Yeah.
I think given that this time around, the only circumstances would be that if the Prime Minister lost, their party would lose as well. Mm. You then just say, okay, the leader of the opposition then goes to the palace. Yeah. Last time around, there were suggestions that that tactical voting might be able to unseat Boris Johnson in Uxbridge.
I believe we'll talk about tactical voting next week.
Or the week after. Nothing happened with that. Johnson made it back in. I would be surprised if Sunak did lose his seat this time around. If he did, then really the Conservatives would be down to such low numbers that it really is then sort of existential risk. And as we talked about earlier, MRP surveys cannot take account of hyperlocal factors, and the PM being the constituency MP is a big hyperlocal factor, but it could work both ways. Tactical voting, for instance, despite the fact there's about a billion candidates in the constituency, tactical voting could mean that all of the anti-Sunak voters combine behind one candidate. Similarly, Sunak won't be campaigning in his own constituency for obvious reasons. So it could get complicated, but I'd be surprised if he were to lose his seat.
Can I share my conspiracy theory, which is that Binface is actually a Tory plant? No, because if you look at it again, like, I think there's a world in which Binface plus Labour would get really, really close to Rishi's kind of overall vote. But because Count Binface is standing, then, you know, Tom Wilson of the Labour Party will probably not win because he is splitting the anti-Tory vote. So what I think, you know, is worth mentioning as well is that obviously Rishi is PM, but he's really not been an MP for that long, because usually when there's a prime minister, and I guess Boris was kind of an exception in a way as well, even though he'd been in Parliament before in a different seat. But you know, normally when you talk about prime minister, you think kind of Theresa May, or you think, you know, party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, etc. People who have been in their constituency for a very long time and people know them, etc. And I think Rishi's been there for like not even a decade, which I find completely baffling.
Yes, that's right. And it will be interesting, of course, as to whether he stays in the Houses of Parliament. And if you were electing an MP in that constituency, would you mind if they then left almost immediately? It's a really interesting decision. I'd invite anyone from Richmond or indeed North Allerton to get in touch and tell us how they're thinking about things.
I'll say my one insight is that currently Tom Wilson, so who's now running in Richmond, is my neighbour in South London. I see him quite a lot. So again, I think that was
going to be a hell of a commute. That was The Polling Station. Please like and leave a review. It helps other people find the podcast. We'll be back next week.